By using surveillance, can we take a look at vaping injuries?
Using fluid from the lungs to determine what causes vaping-related lung injury.
What are the benefits of fasting?
And are there racial differences in the prevalence of diabetes in the United States?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins, and this will be posted on December 27th, 2019.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, let's start with the vaping story, which has just gained so much steam just in the last few weeks. And we mentioned a few different things that have been going on with that. This week, we're talking about two papers in the New England Journal of Medicine. We'll start with this one that's entitled Syndromic Surveillance for E-Cigarette or Vaping Product Use Associated Lung Injury. Ah, that mouthful that trips off the tongue with the phraseology EVALI. They took a look at a bunch of data that was relative to this particular syndrome. They retrospectively identify that on August 1st of this year, the first cases of electronic cigarette vaping product use associated lung injury, I'm going to just call it EVALI from now on in, were reported to the CDC. A cluster that by December 17th of this year had resulted in over 2,500 cases involving hospitalized patients, and had also resulted in 40 plus deaths. The majority of these cases have been in men and adolescent boys, that's 67%, younger than 35 years of age, 78%, and have also been using THC products in 80% of those folks. So they took a look at, well, all right, what can we do here in order to characterize this and be more sensitive to this whole thing in the future? So their description is they overlaid time series of ED visits with data from Google searches and cases of EVALI that were reported to the CDC. They assessed the exposure to e-cigarette products and acute injury in this time period from January 1 to December 7, 2019. So pretty elegant way of overlaying two different data sets. Historically, of course, they noted that the cases gradually increased between the first week of January 2017 and August 11, 2019, particularly in younger people, and they were able to look at a peak incidence, great table that's in this reference. What they also show, of course, is that the incidence has been declining really rapidly. And now we're sort of at a lower level, but still a higher level than we were at the beginning of the year. What we like about this paper, of course, is this elegance of this surveillance data. One thing that the authors note in here is that they're only able to capture about 70% of the entire data set that might be captured if all states participated and health institutions participated. And to me, that's a big outlier that might actually be more revelatory.
This particular thing we're talking about, EVALI, was evaluated using syndromic surveillance, that is, looking at syndromes. This is the first time I can recall that this has been reported nationwide. It doesn't rely upon the diagnosis a physician gives, but it actually gets text from the emergency room visits to identify symptoms people may have, like shortness of breath, or coughing, or gastrointestinal symptoms, or respiratory symptoms. Now, it captures the initial admission diagnosis within 24 hours and the discharge diagnosis no later than a week. So this is real-time monitoring. And by the way, it doesn't require the physician to enter a diagnosis, either an admission or discharge diagnosis, because it can actually capture symptoms. And that's why I think this is such a powerful thing. And as you said, it overlays it with Google to see what people are searching and what they're looking at.
Right, where potentially we would be able to intervene. And I think it is right that these queries and this shortness of breath symptomatology, they note the coincidence of that with the mention of the products as well as this symptom showing up much more often.
And a lot of looking at epidemics is looking at the temporal relationship between where things occur, when they start, when they peak, and when they decline, and associating with environmental, or in this particular case, certain vaping products.
Let's talk about the second one in this issue of the New England Journal of Medicine, this bronchoalveolar lavage and what it reveals.
For listeners that may not be familiar, bronchoalveolar lavage, we're going to call it BAL to shorten it, involves putting a bronchoscope into the pulmonary tree, putting a little fluid in, and withdrawing that fluid and analyzing it. Our listeners will recall several months ago when EVALI was first noted, there wasn't any clear idea about what the cause was. Initially, the CDC tried to approach this by analyzing the different products. But many individuals had used multiple products over a variety of different times, so it didn't provide definitive insight into what was causing EVALI. This particular study, however, does. They collected BAL fluids from 51 patients with EVALI in 16 different states and compared that to 99 BAL fluids that had been collected from individuals that either weren't smokers, smoked cigarettes, or smoked e-cigarettes. In the individuals that had vaping-induced lung injury, 94% of those individuals had vitamin E acetate in their bronchoalveolar lavage, as opposed to 0 of the 99 control individuals. When they began to look at the THC products, the vast majority of them had vitamin E acetate, whereas the nicotine-containing products did not.
And I think it's also worth noting, and they describe in the text of this study, that this was added as a diluent to dilute the THC because it's similar in viscosity and similar in some other characteristics. And that's also in contrast to nicotine-containing products, which other diluents are used in. And that coincident of that peak of EVALI injuries also is coincident with when this vitamin E acetate started to be used.
Absolutely. And as much as 50% of the product may be vitamin E acetate.
My question is, are those THC-containing products now, they must be using something other than vitamin E acetate because we see the incidence is declining so much.
Well, Elizabeth, that's one possible explanation. The other explanation is that because of the press, people are less likely to vape THC products. The last thing you want to do is have biologic plausibility. And we know that the vitamin E acetate interferes with surfactant. That's the protein that coats the small lining of the lung and is responsible for keeping the surface tension right to make respiration as efficient as possible.
Well, this story, it's good to finally have the putative agent in sight, I think, and hopefully more press that just says to people, hey, just don't do this. Bad idea.
Your point's well taken.
We're going to stay in the New England Journal of Medicine, and we're going to take a look at an exhaustive review paper that was looking at the benefits of intermittent fasting on health, aging, and disease. This maybe is something that people might want to consider doing in the new year because we've had abundant evidence, and this is reviewed in this very extensive paper, in both rodent models as well as non-human primates and in humans, that fasting of different flavors, if you will, can have multiple benefits on health. And even if you already have some kind of a chronic disease, it looks like it can also help with that. The authors review that intermittent fasting actually elicits evolutionarily conserved so that we have these in all of our different animals as we kind of move up the food chain, adaptive cellular responses that are integrated between and within organs in a manner that improves glucose regulation, increases stress resistance, and suppresses inflammation. And we know that the final common pathway under many diseases, of course, is inflammation. When they take a look at all these models, they're able to show that this intermittent fasting improves obesity, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, cancers, and also neurodegenerative brain diseases. And what happens, of course, when we fast is that we flip our metabolic switch so that we go from glucose metabolites to ketones. And that's what's used to fuel cells during their metabolism. It also turns out that there are more long-term effects of that as well, that flip switches for up and down regulation of other cellular processes that are going on and have this multitude of benefits.
Listeners might say, well, gosh, I'm not surprised because when you fast, you lose weight. But what we should realize is in animal models and in clinical studies in which they've compared just weight reduction versus intermittent fasting, that the benefits for intermittent fasting are not just due to weight loss itself. There are several ways to do intermittent fasting. You can do alternate day fasting where you eat one day and not eat the next. There's what's called the 5-2 plan, where for every 7 days you fast 2 days, you eat the other five. Or the other is, on a regular day, is you make sure you're not eating for 16 to 18 hours of that particular day. Well, what I notice that it's very difficult in the United States to do this because we're so used to advocating that you have to eat three meals a day. But as you suggest, the data, at least in animal models, suggests that intermittent fasting can be helpful for reducing oxidative stress and improving chronic disease and inflammation.
Well, of course, this paper identifies these three different ways of fasting. I'll just bring to your memory that we just talked about a study that took a look at truncating the amount of time during the day that people eat and its benefits in that small study in terms of weight loss as well as the metabolic effects.
Right. And at that time, we didn't call it intermittent fasting, but essentially that's what it is. What I should remind our listeners is that most of these studies were done in animals. Most of the clinical studies in humans were observational studies done in middle-aged individuals and not for a long period of time. You'd like to know whether intermittent fasting, for example, is healthy in older individuals and whether it has long-term effects as well.
I'll just cite for you a couple of the studies that were in here, both in older people as well as in people with cancer that they review that does show that there's a benefit to this intermittent fasting model. They also show that it could be a benefit in Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's disease.
It does appear to show some benefit in smaller studies, at most over 2 years. I'm not saying that it doesn't have benefit. I'm just saying we need additional studies.
I would agree with that, and I would say that I thought that the authors sort of bowed out in a way I really consider to be lukewarm at the end of this paper, where they said, oh, we've just got all these cultural barriers, and we also have barriers with regard to physician advice on this, and it's going to be a really tough call. And I would say, yeah, that's okay, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't advocate for it.
Your point's well taken. Let's go on to the next one, Elizabeth, since we're talking about diet. And we know that obesity and diabetes are rampant. These authors used the NHANES data from 2011 to 2016. This included samples of people that were 20 years or older who had either self-reported diagnosed diabetes during an interview, or they had measurements of their hemoglobin A1C or fasting plasma glucose levels to determine whether they had undiagnosed diabetes. The diabetes did differ substantially across different races. The prevalence of diabetes, diagnosed and undiagnosed, was 12% for whites, 20% for blacks, 22% for Hispanic, and 19% for non-Hispanic Asian groups. Among the Hispanics, they looked at Mexicans, Puerto Ricans, Cuban, Dominicans, and Central Americans, and there was about a twofold difference between, for example, the Mexicans and Central Americans. The Mexicans had a prevalence of about 25%, and the Central Americans about 12%. Among the Asians subgroups, there wasn't as much of a difference.
Let's just note that this was in the Journal of the American Medical Association, clearly pointing to the need for targeted awareness campaigns to bring these folks forward, because we know that the consequences of untreated diabetes can be quite dire.
Absolutely. The editorial points out that for whites, if their BMI is over 25, it suggests that they'd be screened for diabetes or prediabetes. But in Asians, they have diabetes at a lower BMI, and it's recommended they be screened if their BMI is 23 or higher. And unfortunately, despite those recommendations, that's oftentimes not the case.
Awareness needed. We won't talk to our listeners before it's actually the new year. I would say for our New Year's resolution advice, consider intermittent fasting. And if you are at risk for diabetes, get screened.
Those are great New Year's resolutions.
On that note, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.